This meeting will come to order. Our members are a little slow to arrive. We haven't quite gotten them in the groove yet, but we will. And I appreciate Ruth, Scott, and John. You're on time. That's wonderful. And we will get the others here in short order and on time next time. But in any case, I want to welcome Jim Nobles, our legislative auditor, here this morning. We are going to hear, this is a task force report that came in during the interim, and it's on integration revenue, which is a big deal to some schools around the state and a very little deal for some other schools around the state, but something I think we need to look at and consider what we might want to look at for the future of this revenue. So with that, thank you very much, Mr. Noble, for coming here and being here today, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is Judy Randall. And in just a moment, Ms. Randall is going to make a brief presentation of our findings and recommendations. I think we all recognize that racial integration continues to be an ever-present and complicated challenge for many Minnesota schools. And to help schools meet that challenge, the legislature started giving school districts extra money in the 1980s. At first, the extra money went just to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. But in 1997, the legislature created the School Integration Revenue Program and set eligibility criteria that allow many more districts to receive extra funding. And in fiscal year 2005, 80 school districts participated in the program and spent about $79 million on a wide range of activities. We found that schools are using their integration revenue to accomplish good things. For example, some districts are using the revenue to reduce class sizes, others to close the achievement gap, and others to increase cultural awareness and sensitivity. In other words, we think schools are using integration revenue in ways that meet the good public purpose test. But before we say all is well, we think the legislature has to also ask, as we did, two other questions. Is integration revenue being distributed fairly? In other words, are the school districts that are receiving the revenue receiving it in amounts that are commensurate with the challenges that they face? And the second question we think you need to ask, as we did, is the money being spent not just to accomplish good things, but also in ways that promotes the program's purpose? This morning, you're going to be told by us, and I think by others, that neither question has a simple answer. You will hear from our evaluation that sometimes there is a questionable relationship between the amount of revenue some districts receive and the challenges they face. You're also going to hear that it is often difficult to say whether the expenditures promote the program's purpose because, frankly, we think the program's purpose is not clear. In fact, you're going to hear that there are many competing interpretations of what this program is trying to accomplish. This makes it difficult for anyone to define the program's spending parameters. What is allowed and not allowed is not an easy question to answer for this program. Over time, we think this lack of clarity will undermine the rationale that this is a special program, targeted at a special challenge, open only to some school districts. We already see that some use of integration revenue is aimed more at general educational objectives, not the special challenge of racial integration. If it is to remain a special program available to only some districts, we think the legislature should clarify the purpose of the program and precisely define what it is aiming to accomplish. And then the program should move forward with the Department of Education reviewing the budgets and the expenditures and ensure that districts use integration revenue only for its intended purpose. To tell you more about what we found and what we recommend, I now want to call on Ms. Randall to make a further presentation to you. And again, Madam Chair and members, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Ms. Randall?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you. My name is Judy Randall, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. In spring of 2005, last spring, the Legislative Audit Commission asked us to do an evaluation of the Integration Revenue Program. We released this report in the middle of November, and I'm happy to be here today to share with you our findings and recommendations. Let me kind of jump right to our bottom line, which is that the program needs more focus and oversight. Specifically, we found that the purpose of the program is not clear, that school districts use the revenue in a variety of ways, mostly for good purposes, but some we thought were troubling. The Department of Education has not provided the required oversight of the program, and the funding formula has some unintended consequences. I'm going to spend more time on each of these findings as I go through the presentation, but before I do that, let me take a step back and give you a refresher and overview of what this program is about. In fiscal year 2005, 80 school districts received $79 million. 2 points here. First, $79 million is a significant amount of money. And second, not all school districts received these funds. 80 of the 341 school districts in fiscal year 2005 received the funding. School districts are eligible, can be identified as eligible to receive the funds or can voluntarily participate. There are a couple of different ways a district is identified as eligible. The first is if a school district has a racially identifiable school. Racially identifiable school is a school in which the protected student enrollment or the minority student enrollment is significantly higher than the district-wide average for the grade level served by that school of protected student enrollment. It's complicated. Let me give you an example. Rosemont Apple Valley Egan in fiscal year 05 had an elementary school with 43% protected student enrollment. That was significantly higher, at least 20 percentage points higher, than the district-wide average protected student enrollment of 19 percentage points. As a result, Rosemont Apple Valley Egan was eligible for integration revenue funds. It needed to develop an integration plan focused intra-district, so within its district, to increase interracial contact. Another way school districts can be identified as eligible for the funds is if they're an isolated district. In this case, it's the district as a whole has a significantly larger protected student population than the neighboring or adjoining district. In this case, both the isolated district and those neighboring adjoining districts are eligible for the funds. Again, a little complicated, so we put together a graph. Here in the red is St. Paul. It's the red isolated district at 72% protected student enrollment. Here in the yellow are the neighboring or adjoining districts. Here's Roseville, North St. Paul, South Washington County, South St. Paul, West St. Paul. Under the Integration Revenue Program, all of these districts, the red isolated and the yellow adjoining, are eligible for the funds. They must work together across district bounds to develop an integration plan and do inter-district activities to increase interracial contact. Now, a district can also voluntarily participate in the program. In this case, a district that's not required or defined as eligible to participate can join up with an isolated district, one of those red districts, and say, we'll work with you across district bounds, develop an integration plan, and do increased interracial contact activities. So again, here's St. Paul in the red, the isolated district. These pinkish-purple districts are voluntary districts. Here's White Bear Lake, Motto Medi, Stillwater, and Inver Grove Heights. They have all joined up to work with St. Paul across district bounds, developed an integration plan, and therefore receive the integration revenue. Here is a map of the state, and you can see where the districts are located that participate in the program. Again, the red are the isolated districts. The yellow are the adjoining neighboring districts. The pinkish-purple are those voluntary districts, and then the green districts are those that only had racially identifiable schools. You can see they're really clustered around the Twin Cities and southwestern Minnesota, although there's a little bit of a scattering across the state. All right, that's my quick refresher on the program. Now I'm going to go back to our findings and talk about each of those in a little more detail. The first one was that the purpose of the program was not clear. In fact, there are lots of different ideas about what this program is about. We met with 20 different school districts that participated in the program and heard more than 20 different ideas about what the program is for. I'm going to share some of them with you here today. The purpose is to increase parent involvement, to provide staff development, to offer all-day kindergarten, to achieve student success, to integrate the community, to mitigate racial isolation, and on and on and on. You can see there were lots of different ideas about what this program is about. Keep going, but it will stop. There we go. We took all these ideas together and put them into kind of six broad categories. To achieve racial balance and integration, to reduce the achievement gap, to provide staff development, to increase multicultural awareness among students and staff, to increase community involvement, and to provide increased interracial contact. The reason why we think this is worth pointing out is because, again, not all school districts receive these funds. There are a lot of things on these lists that I'm sure every school district would like to do, but not every school district receives the money to do it. So again, as Mr. Noble said earlier, if this is, you know, a special program with special purpose, we think that needs to be clarified. Because again, only some of the school districts receive the funds. So there's lots of different ideas about what the purpose of this program is about. Not surprising, our next finding is that districts use the money in a variety of ways. Lots of them were for good things. A number of districts in the Twin Cities area do inter-district magnet schools. An example of this is the Northwest Suburban Integration School District, which is a collaborative of seven districts in the Northwest metro area. They have magnet schools in all of the participating school districts. Students from any of those seven school districts can attend any of those magnet schools. This is a really kind of creative way of getting students and families to actually cross district boundaries. Another use of the revenue we saw more in the Twin Cities area was classroom partnerships. And St. Paul and the East Metro Group, a collaborative of 10 districts in the East Metro area, do this a lot, where they'll have a St. Paul classroom partner up with a suburban classroom, and they will get together on a monthly or quarterly or a regular basis to work on projects and build, you know, relationships on a regular basis with students that are outside of their district. In the southwestern Minnesota area, we saw more activities that took place outside of the school day or school year, in large part due to geographic constraints. We saw summer academic camps or soccer camps. But again, this was a way to bring students together in a regular way to build meaningful relationships with students from other districts. A number of school districts also use the funds for multicultural festivals to help educate people, you know, students about different cultures. We did see some use of the revenue that we thought was questionable. Specifically, one district used the funds to purchase U.S. history textbooks. Another school district used the funds to provide English language learner services to existing students. Even in a program with such broad allowable expenses, you know, that people have such broad ideas about what this program is about, we felt that these things fell out of the bounds of those parameters. These are things that are existing requirements of school districts. I'm going to move on to our next finding, which is regarding the department. So the department has not provided the required oversight of the program. Specifically, the Department of Education is responsible for evaluating school districts' integration plans to see if the districts are meeting their goals. And at the point of doing our report, the department had not done this. The department is also responsible for reviewing school districts that have racially identifiable schools to see if they have intentional segregation. Intentional segregation is when a racially identifiable school is identifiable because of acts that are discriminatory in nature. At the point of our doing our report, there were 12 districts that needed to have this review done. The department had completed three and was in the process of doing three more, but they were not up to date on these reviews. And finally, for those districts that have had racially identifiable schools for three or more years, the department is supposed to work with those districts to review their integration plans and see if they can help the districts be more strategic and help them accomplish their goals. Now, I will say that the department has made a lot of improvements over the past year. Last spring, they issued guidelines to all school districts on how they thought the funds should be used. And this past summer, they provided increased scrutiny over the department's or over school districts' integration budgets. The last finding that I want to talk about today is regarding the funding distribution, and that we think it has some unintended and troubling consequences. There's two in particular that I want to talk about. One is that the way the funding is allocated, it does not reflect districts' different needs under the program. And the second is that because of the way the funding is allocated, some in statute and some through a formula, there's actually limited oversight over Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and the voluntary districts. Now, before I get into each of these in more detail, let me again take a step back and kind of remind you about how the funding is allocated. Probably the most important thing to remember is that while a district is eligible for the funds based on their protected student enrollment, once they're eligible, the funding is allocated on a total per pupil basis. So there's a funding rate, and it's times every student in the district. It's not just based on the protected student enrollment. Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth have their funding rate, their per pupil funding rate, set out in statute. Minneapolis receives $480 per total per student. St. Paul, $445. Duluth, $206. This is a mix of state and local funds. Minneapolis has permission to do an additional $35 local levy, which is why it receives $35 more per student than St. Paul. For all other districts, their funding rate depends on their protected student enrollment. So an isolated school district, if it has less than or equal to 15% protected student enrollment, it receives $92 per student, again, per every student. And if it has more than 15%, it receives $129 per student. This formula holds true for the adjoining school districts and a district with a racially identifiable school. So their per pupil funding rate is either $92 or $129. An important thing to note here is that there are many districts that meet multiple criteria. So you could have an adjoining school district with a racially identifiable school. They don't receive more money because of that. They, again, just receive either the $92 or the $129. Finally, voluntary districts receive $92 regardless of their protected student enrollment. Just to show you kind of how this plays out, Minneapolis receives a little over $21 million. Well, in fiscal year 5, it received a little over $21 million in integration revenue. St. Paul, $21 million. Duluth, $2.5 million. Collectively, these three districts received over half of the funds in fiscal year 05. They received, it was like 55 or 57% of the funds. Here are just a sampling of other districts. You can see that there's really a broad range of the funds of the integration revenue. So you've got Minneapolis, St. Paul with $21 million, and it goes down to Round Lake with $15,000 in integration revenue. Two that I'll just point out here on this slide are Eden Prairie and Mountain Lake. Eden Prairie is one of those voluntary pinkish-purple districts on the map. Because it's voluntary, it receives $92 per student. But because it's a large district and the $92 funding rate is multiplied by every student, they receive over $1 million in integration revenue. And then Mountain Lake is an isolated district, one of those red districts in southwestern Minnesota. It has over 15% protected student enrollment, so it receives that higher funding rate of $129. But again, because it's so small, it only received $74,000 in integration revenue. Why is this important, and why are we talking about this? Again, not all school districts receive the funds. Districts receive the funds because of their protected student enrollment. We think that purpose should be tied to how districts receive the money and that the money should be linked to their responsibilities under the program. We put together a graph that shows Stillwater and Brooklyn Center here to kind of highlight this point. Stillwater is one of those pinkish-purple voluntary districts. In fiscal year 05, it had about 5% protected student enrollment. Brooklyn Center is one of those red, isolated districts. In fiscal year 05, it had 66% protected student enrollment. Again, because the funding is allocated on a per-pupil basis, Stillwater received almost $1 million in integration revenue, while Brooklyn Center received about $250,000. If you look at this on a revenue per protected student basis, Stillwater is receiving over $2,200 per protected student, while Brooklyn Center received about $223 per protected student. Again, it gets back to what is the purpose of this program and what are the responsibilities of the districts under this program. The other finding regarding the funding that we want to talk about is the limited oversight of the revenue. The Department of Education does not approve the integration budgets for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. All other school districts must submit an integration budget to the department, and the department must approve it before they can receive their funds. Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth do not need their budgets approved by the department in order to receive their funds. Again, as I mentioned earlier, these three districts collectively received over half of the funding and do not need their budgets approved. The other issue is voluntary districts don't need the department's approval. If Stillwater wants to work with St. Paul and St. Paul wants to work with Stillwater and they submit a plan, then Stillwater can receive the funds. There's no review by the department to make sure that a voluntary district can really support the purpose of the program and, you know, further the integration goals under the program. In fiscal year 05, there were six school districts that were voluntary districts. They were
White Bear Lake, Matamidi, Stillwater, Inver Grove Heights, Eden Prairie, and Murray County Central. And collectively, they received $3.4 million in 05. All right, so I know I've just thrown a lot at you. Let me give you a little recap of the findings. The purpose of the program is not clear. Districts use the revenue in a variety of ways, mostly for good things, but some we thought were questionable. The Department of Education has not provided required oversight, and the funding formula has some unintended consequences. So what do we suggest that we do about it? The recommendations that we'll talk about here today, there are more at the back of the report. First, we think the legislature should clarify the purpose of the program. Is this about the achievement gap? Is this about racial balance? Is it about racial tolerance? The school district staff that we spoke with wanted more clarity, and the Department of Education thinks more clarity would be good, too. We think that a clearer purpose would help drive more consistent spending among districts, but also help the Department of Education evaluate what school districts' integration plans and better identify if districts are doing and achieving what the state intended with this program. We think the department should fulfill its responsibilities, which they are already making strides to doing. We think the legislature should consider changing the funding formula. In the back of the report, we list several different options to consider. One that I'll just mention here is perhaps linking the funding more directly to the responsibility of a district. So an isolated district would receive a certain amount of money, an adjoining district would receive a different amount, but an adjoining district with racially identifiable schools who has more responsibilities might yet receive another rate, another amount of funding. And finally, we recommend that the legislature close the oversight gap. Specifically, have the Department of Education have budget approval authority over Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth for their integration revenue budget, and also have voluntary districts be required to get approval from the department and demonstrate how they can support the integration goals before they're eligible to receive funds. With that, I'll end the presentation. I'd be happy to take questions. I know there's a lot on the agenda. Thank you.
Members, what I think I'd like to do next is, if you wouldn't mind staying there, I ask Lisa Larson and Tim Strong to kind of go over the history of why we have integration aid, you know, the what brought us to this point, and then also over the funding over time, because this is a forecast program. Funding is put into the forecast, so when every time another district becomes eligible, that funding is automatically put into place. So I feel that we should better understand how that works. They'll just give a brief overview. We won't do questions on that, and then we'll go back to questions on the integration report, okay? But this might clarify a few things for you before you start asking questions.
Ms. Larson. Madam Chair, members, what I'd like to do is talk about the evolution of school desegregation and the law, and also where Minnesota finds itself in terms of the role of the legislature and the executive branch in addressing school desegregation and integration policies. What I'd like to cover specifically are the following: the role of the federal courts and de jure segregation, urban desegregation remedies, Minnesota's experience with federal court order desegregation, why the role of federal courts diminished, how the state courts played a role in education equity and adequacy lawsuits, what litigation we've experienced in Minnesota courts, and finally a reference to the state school desegregation rules. School desegregation, at least in part, is a discussion about what measures can be used to close the achievement gap between white and minority students. In the 1970s, federal courts played an important role in this discussion. They ordered elected officials to remedy de jure school desegregation by increasing the amount of education spending and other resources available to schools. Kansas City and Missouri are perhaps the most expensive example of this kind of court remedy. A federal court ordered Missouri ultimately to spend more than $3 billion on desegregation aid, much of it for facilities and programs. As federal court-ordered desegregation remedies disappeared, plaintiffs began to seek school desegregation remedies in state courts, arguing that additional resources were needed to provide, quote, an adequate education guaranteed under many state constitutions, close quote. Only de jure segregation is unconstitutional. The United States Supreme Court has never held that the operations of racially segregated schools are per se unconstitutional. The court will regard school operations as unconstitutional only if the racially segregated character of the schools results from intentional official government action. That is called de jure segregation. In the South, de jure segregation was often evidenced by state laws. In the North, de jure segregation was often evidenced by intentional actions of school and other public officials that led to racial segregation. The blueprint for urban school desegregation remedies, and there were few inter-district remedies, to be sure, came in 1974. It was then that the United States Supreme Court in Milken v. Bradley refused to allow the Detroit public schools, which the court found guilty of de jure segregation, to fashion a desegregation remedy with 53 surrounding white suburban school districts, which were not guilty of de jure segregation. Intra-district remedies were possible only where the government action contributed to school segregation between urban and suburban districts, and only if the plaintiffs could prove that a constitutional violation in one district significantly affected segregation in another district. The Detroit-only desegregation plan ordered by the court left the Detroit school district with many predominantly black schools. The Supreme Court was forced to revisit the circumstances of Detroit in a case called that's referred to as Milken 2, and in that case, the court approved as a remedy enhanced educational resources that were intended to compensate for substandard education that students received in the segregated, predominantly black schools in Detroit. Whether the court ultimately intended it or not, Milken, with its compensatory and remedial education programs, in fact became a blueprint for fashioning desegregation remedies. These remedies might include everything from capital improvements, reductions in student-teacher ratios, early childhood education, remedial reading, curriculum development, student testing, student counseling, staff development, to things such as increased parent involvement and improved community relations. As I mentioned earlier, the best example of the expansive use of Milken occurred in the Kansas City, Missouri School District, where the state and the district were ordered by the federal court to implement and fund education programs and facilities that were intended to increase black student achievement. Just by the by, in the 1991-92 school year, the Kansas City School District spent more than $9,400 per pupil, as compared to between $2,800 and $5,900 per pupil that the surrounding suburban school districts expended. Federal courts would continue to play an important role in school desegregation cases during the 1980s and into the 1990s, requiring additional resources for predominantly minority school districts. In Minnesota, only the Minneapolis School District came under a federal court-ordered decree. In 1971, black students brought a class action school integration lawsuit on behalf of minority groups who resided in the Minneapolis School District. A federal district court in a case called Booker v. Special School District No. 1 found that the Minneapolis School Board, through discretionary decisions of public officials, had intentionally acted to maintain or increase racial segregation in the schools. The court ordered the district to implement a school desegregation integration plan that included guidelines for allowable percentages of minority students in schools, required faculty integration, it allowed further school construction only with court approval, and required the district to submit to the court status and progress reports. In 1977, the court agreed to increasing the number of minority students allowed in any one school, but would not allow a high concentration of American Indian students in one or a few schools. The court released its jurisdiction of the district in 1983. Until 1995, the district operated under something called the 15% rule that allowed each school to have a minority enrollment no higher than 15% above the district-wide average. There are two reasons why federal courts' role in school desegregation litigation diminished. First, federal court orders were based on the continuing violation of the United States Constitution. Many school districts that were under a federal court order to desegregate persuaded courts that all vestiges of the de jure segregation were eliminated, and therefore that the district could be released from court oversight. A federal court was able to terminate its oversight and the injunction even if the district had racially imbalanced schools, so long as the racially imbalanced schools were a result of de facto segregation caused by private voluntary choices and not government action. The second reason why the federal court's role diminished is that the courts required plaintiffs to determine the incremental effect that segregation had on minority student achievement. The courts would limit the court remedy to eliminating the incremental effect only. This required plaintiffs to show the percent of the achievement gap attributable to segregation. Plaintiffs found it difficult to prove the link between past segregation and minority students' current low achievement levels. The federal court's inhospitality to resolving segregation issues, in fact, began in 1973. This was in a United States Supreme Court ruling called San Antonio v. Rodriguez. In that case, the United States Supreme Court ruled that education was not a fundamental right under the U.S. Constitution, and that glaring disparities in education funding between school districts was not subject to a strict scrutiny test, but to a minimum rational basis test. A strict scrutiny test requires the government to justify its actions according to very stringent requirements. A rational basis test merely requires that the government action show a rational basis. The court in this case found that Texas's use of local property taxes to fund its public schools met the rational basis test and dismissed the case. Consequently, plaintiffs could not use the federal courts to force states to remedy funding inequities between school districts. Thereafter, plaintiffs began to seek educational equity in state courts. Starting with Serrano v. Priest in California in 1976, plaintiffs took their school cases to state courts. When plaintiffs succeeded, the courts ruled that their respective state constitution made education a fundamental right, requiring greater funding equity between school districts in order to meet state constitutional guarantees. Plaintiffs were able to achieve significant reforms through through litigation and also legislative action that followed. While funding disparities among school districts began to disappear and equity cases managed to equalize the amount of funding that school districts in a state spent on each pupil, the problem was this. The cases did not result necessarily in more money for schools if overall state spending remained static. It was at this point that plaintiffs began to seek educational adequacy in addition to equity in state courts, because it was apparent that equity cases did not lead to increased public school spending. Plaintiffs' theory about adequacy required the courts to examine the adequacy of funding levels instead of the equitable allocation of education funds. Although funding equity remained important, plaintiffs began to focus on funding adequacy with the ultimate goal of ensuring that all schools, including those with greater numbers of disadvantaged students, would have sufficient funds to provide all students with an adequate education. Plaintiffs in adequacy suits alleged a violation of the state's duty to provide the educational opportunities that the state constitution guaranteed in its education article. Minnesota had an experience with education equity and adequacy litigation. In a separate school finance lawsuit in 1993, it's called the Scheme v. State, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that Minnesota's education clause, which requires the state legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public schools, made education a fundamental right. In 1995, the Minneapolis branch of the NAACP sued Minnesota, the then-existing State Board of Education, the state legislature, the Metropolitan Council, and claims against the Metropolitan Council were ultimately dismissed, as well as state officials. The plaintiffs argued that segregated education in the Minneapolis school district violated the education article and the Equal Protection Clause of Minnesota's Constitution. The plaintiffs also argued that segregated schools provided students with an inadequate education, reflected in lower test scores and higher non-graduation rates, and negatively impact students' chances for jobs as well as higher education. Finally, the plaintiffs argued that the state's failure to limit the concentration of minority student enrollment in the Minneapolis schools showed that the district was not effectively desegregated. A later, almost identical suit with an additional due process claim was filed in 1998, and Hennepin County District Court consolidated both cases for purposes of trial. In order to avoid extensive litigation, the parties reached a settlement agreement that included three programs. The first allowed low-income Minneapolis students to transfer without any transportation costs to themselves and with the substantial state aid they would generate to suburban schools in Richfield, St. Louis Park, Wayzata, Columbia Heights, Edina, Hopkins, Robbinsdale, St. Anthony, New Brighton, and later Eden Prairie. The program, which was set to expire in June of 2005, was extended for about almost 1,700 students through June of 2006. The second program gave low-income Minneapolis students preferred access to magnet schools within the district. And the third program increased district accountability to Minneapolis parents. The agreement also increased low-income students' access to intra-district transfers and existing magnet programs within the district. At the time the parties reached their settlement agreement, the Minneapolis Education Department adopted administrative rules on school desegregation. These rules contained parameters for identifying the rate or determining the racial balance in schools and school districts. And you heard the legislative auditor describe some of the aspects of these rules. For example, the rules define a racially identifiable school as one with a minority student enrollment that is greater than 20% of the district average for that grade. The rules define a racially isolated school district as one with a minority student enrollment that is greater than 20% above the district-wide enrollment at any adjoining school district. Schools such as charter schools, among others, are exempted from some of the rules' effects. All school districts under the rules are required to annually submit racial composition data to the Education Commissioner in order to identify racially isolated schools. The rules themselves focus on collaboration. The Commissioner must notify a district and its surrounding districts when the Commissioner finds that a district is racially isolated. The affected district is required to establish a multi-district collaboration council. This council identifies ways and develops a four-year plan that the Commissioner must approve to offer cross-district opportunities to improve integration. The rules list integration incentives. They may include such things as transportation aid, cooperative magnet schools, cooperative efforts to recruit minority teachers, community education programs. The rules appear to generally be meant to increase interaction between districts and encourage voluntary desegregation. Under state law, specifically Section 124D.896, the Commissioner is given authority to, quote, address the need for equal educational opportunities for all students and racial balance, close quote. The rules encourage collaboration that supports integration initiatives between racially isolated and non-racially isolated school districts. Of course, statutes and rules are subject to direction by the legislature and the executive branch.
I know, that's an earful, isn't it? And we're not going to entertain questions on this. We'll now go to funding over time, how the funding has changed for this program, and then we will go back to our auditors for with questions if you have some. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, in the interest of saving your committee time, a couple of helpful things, real helpful things for the committee. The legislative auditor's report on the first few pages in the background information section lists some wonderful information for you about the history of the program. Table 1.1, which is on page 5 of that document, summarizes some of the major school integration events in Minnesota history. Coupled with that, you have a three-page handout from the school finance guide for 2005 labeled school desegregation and integration at the top. If you turn to page 77 of that document, you can see the history of integration funding in Minnesota. We could spend time at a later date if members want more information about this, but as you can see from that document, if you start at the bottom of that table, table 40, and work your way up, you can see that the amounts of money started.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Mr. Strump, what document are you on?
If you turn to the three-page document labeled School Drug Desegregation and Integration.
Okay. It's really page 2, but it says page 7.
Right, right.
Okay, no
one wants.
Yeah,
we're looking for the first 30 days. It should have been in your folder for the day.
So, Madam Chair, members, if you want to see how that funding changed over time, you can look at the bottom of the chart there. In 1988, see about $11.5 million in state aid was going out in the program, and about $1.9 million of levy. And you can see how that increased over time. There were some big changes at a couple of different points in time, and then as other districts began participating in the program in fiscal year 2000, the costs have grown substantially since then. One other set of notes for you on this. When the program started, there were essentially not a statutory program, but rather individual grants created by law for the program. This was an intentional legislative decision at that point in time that these amounts should just be year-to-year appropriations. The money, when it was initially started, was also divided into two pots. There was essentially a transportation pot and a program pot. Those were combined, and now there's just a single formula amount that Ms. Randall told you about earlier. So in the interest of saving time, Madam Chair, I think that's probably enough. If the members want details on the specific changes in the years we made those changes, I'd be happy to do that at a later date.
All right, and I want to thank you, Mr. Strawn, and you, Ms. Larson. I know it's not easy to put something like that together, and it's really quite complicated, and there's quite a history, as you can see. And I think in Minnesota, in a sense, maybe we've been fortunate, because in a lot of ways we have moved ahead and provided the equity and so on that the courts are looking for. But now, if there's questions on the auditor's report, I'll be amazed if there aren't, but if there aren't, we can move on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
I guess everybody read this and memorized it. We'll move on to, we are going to have testimony today from the Minneapolis area, variety of people, the St. Paul area, variety of people. And then also we had the superintendent from the Rochester district here to give us some insight into that. So at this point, Mr. Grathwall, you were going to introduce, I believe, the people testifying in the Minneapolis area. So please, I don't know if you're going to do this, all of you coming forward at once. That will be fine. We need a couple more chairs, and there are plenty of them sitting around here.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While we're waiting, can we get a copy of Ms. Larson's testimony? Do we have a copy of that?
We don't.
Oh,
we
you
don't
type it up. Okay.
We don't have copies at the moment. I only.
I'll just give her a call.
Yeah, I only ask for an oral report. Okay. I think some of it is in here in the background, however. And then I just finished reading a different report that was put together by Myra Northfield. A rather long one. You might prefer Ms. Larson's.
Okay.
Mr. Grathwall.
Madam Chair members, my name is Jim Grathwall, representing the Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm joined by Janet Boyer, our Director of Diversity and Equal Opportunity, and Jackie Turner, Director of our Student Placement Office. And I'm sure they're going to enjoy this as much as I am. And Dan Jeff,
what does that mean?
For education program. This is fun.
Okay.
You know, we loved it.
Good. We're glad you enjoy it.
Right. So thanks for having this hearing and taking the time. I'm going to just draw your attention. In your packet, you have some slides. I'm not going to review them. There won't be a quiz, but it's about kind of how we're doing on closing the gap. One of the purposes of the desegregation or integration revenue. So again, I ask you to review them. There isn't a quiz, but generally what it shows is data over time on NCLB indicators, your No Child Left Behind indicators, your MCA tests from the state level, and a bunch of the tests look like this. I'm breaking the rule. I'm directing your attention to them. And I just want you to note, over time, fewer and fewer students in level one, kind of a flat trend in level two, increasing trends in level three and four and five. That's what you want to see. So for the audience at home, the trend you want to see is movement of students out of level one, across level two, and increasing in levels three, four, and five. If our testimony does not hold your attention and you want to have fun with math, I would recommend you check out in 1999 in Minneapolis in reading or math how many students were in level one or two. Compare that to the most recent year, how many were in levels one or two, and I think you'll be happy, if not surprised, with the outcome there. So let me just make a few introductory comments and then turn it over to my associates. And I just want to state for the record that I want to thank the legislative audit. I think it's a good report. I want to thank legislative staff for their review of the law and finance, and just state that we operate, Minneapolis Public Schools operates a premier public school choice program to accomplish the goals of the DSEG, basically the law and rule framework we have in place, increase opportunities for racial interaction, and closing the achievement gap. I've already addressed the packet of selected slides, but you'll note progress on closing the gap, increasing graduation rates, and closing gaps for racial minorities while all students increase student achievement. This isn't to say that those gaps don't still exist. They do across all those indicators, but I want you to note the progress that's been made. And I'm going to assert, and we can address this in Q&A later, that the current desegregation rule and law need updating to reflect current realities. And one is that the metro area is metropolitan Twin Cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Minnesota are one of the most segregated in the country, and that the region's racial diversity is growing, but concentrated in the urban core and first-ring suburbs. And finally, failure to address the underlying facts of segregation, housing, employment, transportation, limits school success under those NCLB indicators, and threatens the region's economic future, which is the point you'll be hearing about in the Minding the Gap report. So I'm now going to turn it over to Ms. Turner, and you've just been delivered a large packet, so you've got lots of homework, and again, there's no accountability for you, but I would encourage you to look at the packet that you've just received, which has on one side elementary school choices in Minneapolis, and on the other side high school choices, and describes the plethora, the variety of school choices available. And if Representative Biskins were here, he would probably, after reviewing the packet, withdraw his voucher bill because he would understand exactly how many choices we actually have. So, Ms. Turner, thank you.
Good morning. I just want to speak a little bit about some of the choice programs within the district and just to explain how we use our integration aid. We primarily use it on three purposes. One is to provide transportation. Mr. Grathaw talked about how Minneapolis is one of the most segregated cities in the country, and without the transportation dollars, we would not be able to support our magnet schools as we do such. Most of our magnet schools look at are very diversified, right? About 30% white families, 30% African-American, and 30% some other ethnicity in the schools where we provide and support the transportation in those magnet schools. Also within those magnet schools, you'll see that achievement is doing well. There's a theme typically, whether it be the arts or IB or an open program or a Montessori that is attractive across all economic levels, all racial levels. And those programs are doing quite well. We also are supporters of the West Metro Education Project, the programs that the Interdistrict Downtown School, which is located in downtown, and the Fine Arts School in Crystal. Minneapolis is a strong supporter of both of those programs and fulfill our allotment each year and actually go over in some cases of filling our allotment there. So it's another opportunity for integration with families. Our high school programs, although there are only seven high schools, there's over 20 programs within those seven high schools that are citywide magnets per se. We call them small learning communities in Minneapolis, but those programs as well are diversified and offer a number of integration opportunities for students.
One of those programs is highlighted in that article in your package, the Washburn Girls Space. They're building a plane coming to a district near you soon.
The other portion of the money is used to support themes and programs in those particular magnet schools to make them attractive, and then a small portion is also used to support my office, which I think is a value piece to this whole plan, is that we look and provide and counsel and consult with families about their many choices. The average kindergarten family, if you just look at the Minneapolis choices and you take out the charter and you take out the Choice is Yours program, still have about 12 to 15 different opportunities to enter into school. And so that's a lot of work with families to talk about their different opportunities that they have within the district. We also, in Minneapolis, like Mr. Grethel said, support choice. So about half of our families choose the magnet programs where diversity is equally distributed, and about half choose community schools. And we believe in Minneapolis, we support choice, but we also support community schools for those parents that want it. Although, even in those community schools, one of the things that we would like to challenge this committee to look at and consider is that even in some of those community schools, they are still diverse. There may not be white families there, but they are still diverse. They're diverse with African families, African-American families, Hispanic, Latino families, Hmong families, East African, Russian, Cambodian. And so those schools are still diverse. Families are still experiencing a rich part of diversity. They just may not have a white person sitting in their class, but they are still very valued diversity, we feel. Our magnets are also doing a good job of drawing open enrollment families, particularly our Spanish immersion program is drawing a number of families from outside the city limits, as well as our international baccalaureate program, both at the high school level and our primary level. And we actually like to entertain the idea of open up bus in both ways, not only to support and allow families to leave the city to go out to the suburbs, but to also look at possibly supporting suburban families with transportation into Minneapolis. And that's primarily what we use our integration aid on.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Ms. Boyer?
Yes, good morning. My name is Janet Thomas Boyer. I'm the Director of Diversity and Equal Opportunity for the Minneapolis School District, and I want to share some additional facts related to our desegregation efforts and some of the challenges that we face. As we learned earlier, Minneapolis is the only district in the state to have had a court-ordered and court-supervised desegregation plan. Between 1972 and 1983, we had 11 years of court supervision. During that time, we developed a system of school choice that included magnet schools and citywide busing to fulfill the plan. Over 12 years, Minneapolis filed 17 reports with the state to document intent to end desegregation. The first year of a court-supervised desegregation plan, Minneapolis had 18% students of color. That's comparable to South Washington County or Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan, in terms of what those particular districts look like today. Today, Minneapolis public schools has 73% students of color. We also have 17 racially identifiable schools. In other words, and generally speaking, we have 17 schools where students of color are at least 20 percentage points over the district average of 73%. Let me say that another way. We have 17 schools that are comprised of 93% or more students of color. I think Thurgood Marshall, one of the NAACP lawyers who helped win the landmark Brown versus Board of Education case, would be surprised and probably disappointed to know that we still have so many segregated schools. But that does not mean that we lack effort in trying. We continue to have the will and put forth the effort to desegregate our schools, but we face many competing factors. The city of Minneapolis has realized an increase in the percentage of students of color over several years. In 1990, the city had 22%, residents of color. In 1990, the city had 22% non-white residents. In the year 2000, according to the census data, we have 35% residents of color. Increased residents of color have resulted in increased students of color for the Minneapolis School District. We went from 35% students of color in 1983 to 73% today. Couple that explosion with the fact that the cities and neighborhoods are increasingly segregated, it's no wonder we have segregated schools. And couple that with the DSEG rule that no longer fits the current situation of today. For example, the rule fails to give us credit, as Jackie mentioned before, for the rich diversity that we do and see in some of our schools. We have schools that have huge numbers of students of color, but those students are African-American students, students from Somalia, Kenya, Oromo, Puerto Rico, Mexico, South America, Ecuador. We have Hmong students in those schools, Chinese, Japanese students. They're all in the same building, they're all learning together, and they're all learning about each other's culture. But the rule counts such a setting against us.
In other words, what you're saying is since only whites count on the other side of the ledger, therefore you aren't considered desegregated.
Right.
Representative Cleansing.
Specifically to that issue, since the desegregation is this policy or statute is based on response to a court case, how does the court case define segregation, and how does that then parallel the way that we set up the statute?
Madam Chair, Jim Grathwell. I might defer to counsel Lisa Larson, but I would imagine it's a black-white. In the court regimen, it's black-white. I don't know if you want to entertain my imagination.
I don't think Ms. Larson feels equipped to respond to that one. But I think your assumption, the assumption that it's white, and then other students of color is probably, and you would prefer that it could be seen as desegregated when you had a whole variety of students from various backgrounds, correct?
Right.
And you didn't even mention Hispanic yet. Okay, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you.
Another issue that we have with the rule is that it promotes, in our opinion, it promotes student exodus from Minneapolis by paying for transportation out of the district to Choice is Yours, but it does not pay for transportation for suburban students who want to come into the district. According to the way the DSEG rule is currently written, getting more white students into the district really is the only way that we're going to be able to desegregate. The rule does not address the underlying housing, employment, and transportation policies which create segregated communities. And finally, desegregation mandates do not apply equally to our competing education service providers, charter schools. Single-race charter schools are allowed to form unfettered in the district, and those are one of our biggest competitors. Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren said it well when he read the majority opinion in the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 that ordered desegregation of schools. He said, and I paraphrase, quote, "Today, education is perhaps the most important function of state and local governments. In these days, it's doubtful that any child may reasonably be expected to succeed in life if he is denied the opportunity of an education," end quote. If we believe that desegregating is truly an important aspect of educating our children, as the court did in 1954, then we have to simultaneously work on desegregating housing, employment, and transportation. And we have to build an effort such as Choice is Yours. Thank you.
Representative Griling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Thomas Foyer, I want to follow up on your comment about the charter schools. I wasn't aware of that they didn't have to desegregate in Minneapolis. Is that because they didn't exist when the lawsuit came, or why did, since they're public schools, why don't they have to follow it?
Madam Chair, Representative Riley,
Mr. Grathwell.
Minneapolis DSEG plan applies to the Minneapolis public schools. Charter schools are separate public schools, but the plan is one of the Minneapolis public schools.
So, Madam Chair.
So, the Minneapolis public schools are getting funding for this, but the charters at this point are not, correct?
Correct, nor are they held accountable. And it would,
right.
It's a problem for us where we have we get a racially isolated label and tag on a school with 93% students of color, no matter how diverse, yet our competitors can offer, and this is not just in Minneapolis, this is around the metro area, single race or single ethnic charters, which, you know, whether or not that's good educational policy, it's something that is not difficult for us to do and doesn't meet a DSEG, becomes a problem under the DSEG regime.
Representative Grating.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grathwell, are any of them all pretty much white, or are they an ethnic group?
Actually, they're more ethnic group or single race.
Okay.
I mean, and I can get more detail on that.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To any of the presenters, what was the court-ordered desegregation plan, and has the Minneapolis district conform to that plan? Have you been successful?
Mr. Grathwell.
Madam Chair, Representative Newman, Jim Grathwell again. The plan that you see in your packet and that we briefly presented was the, and Ms. Larson mentioned, it was setting limits on 15%, I believe, but over time the court changed the limits on the concentration of minority students at individual sites, and then it became a 15, rather than 15% or 20% at individual sites, I believe it went to no more than 20% more minority concentration of minority at a given site and at a grade level across the district-wide grade level average. So the plan has changed a little bit, but in essence it's been setting really strong positive association, but a quota of minority students which one should not exceed at any given site. That quota turned into kind of a banded limit that you should not have more than 20% more students of color at any given site in the grade configuration to make up for the fact that there's K-5s, there's 6-8s, there's high schools, and then sometimes your schools move among those configurations. But essentially it's been trying to limit, or the essence of the DSEG plan has been preventing school boards from concentrating students of color at one site through either a quota or a floating band of limit on students of color at any one site. And when we exceed that, currently in Minneapolis at 17 sites, we have more than 93% students of color at 17 sites. That's in excess of 20% of our district-wide average of 73%. I'm not sure from your expression I've answered your question.
Mr. Newman, I'm going to ask Ms. Larson to clarify, because Minneapolis is no longer under a court order.
If I could just ask one very easy, I hope, brief follow-up question, sir.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm just looking for your opinion. In your opinion, has the Minneapolis School District been successful in complying with the court order desegregation plan? Yes or no, we'll see.
Yes.
Thank you.
And Ms. Larson, we're no longer under a court-ordered plan, so.
Yes. Madam Chair, members, my apologies for the confusion. If I'm correct in this, the program that the witnesses are discussing right now is not a result of any kind of requirement under law. It's not the result of any requirement as a result of a court order. This is a voluntary program that the district has initiated.
Madam Chair.
You know, we'll go on for the moment, but I think there will be more clarification of that. And then, was one of you going to talk about the Choice is Yours program? Okay, that would be Mr. Jett. Ms. Bouye, had you completed your testimony?
Yes.
All right, then we will go on to Mr. Jett, who is the WEMAP superintendent. Maybe you want to explain what that is.
I'll be happy to. Madam Chair and members, you have a packet at your place that was delivered that looks this color on the front. If I could walk you through that briefly.
Okay. One more clarification.
Yeah, Madam Chair, my profuse apologies. I think what I need to do is say this, that the program we're discussing is a result of what the rule requires. It is not a court order. It is not state law. It's a result of the rule, the racially isolated districts, identifiable districts, and so forth. And that's really what is the premise for this program. And my apologies for the confusion. And
Madam
we'll
Chair.
Never forgive you, Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, if I may, the purpose of my question was originally this desegregation plan, or the genesis of it, was apparently it's some type of a court order plan.
Yes.
Which was how many years ago? 30 years ago?
No.
Okay.
70. Well.
And so now we're in the year 2006, and so, you know, between that original plan and now we are operating under a rule. My basic overall question to the one district in the state of Minnesota that started under a court order plan was whether or not there has been any degree of success. Because candidly, when I listen to the Minneapolis School District, it appears that they are saying they have been successful. Whereas when we listened to the Department of Education yesterday and the auditor today, just the opposite is true, unless I'm completely misunderstanding this.
Well, what you were hearing yesterday are statewide, you know, totally statewide statistics, so it wasn't just a bearing on Minneapolis, for instance.
That's true, Madam Chair, but we're still dealing with integration aid on a state level, of which this particular school district receives really a very large share.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you know, I think one of the things that happened, Mr. Newman, Representative Newman, in the interim between the time that they were under the forced busing, there was also a great deal of flight out of the city of Minneapolis, which made their population more heavily concentrated minority. Because of all the busing rules, some people just chose to leave the city. And I think it did change the look of the community to a certain extent. Now, of course, we have another wave with a lot of new integration into the city, which has also had another big effect on the city and the population, particularly the school population. Mr. Representative Dabney, you know, I've been out of this place for too long. I'm too used to Mr. and Mrs.
Yeah, frankly, Madam Chair, I respond to Jim pretty well, too. So.
All right. Maybe we'll do it that way.
That'd be just fine. Representative Newman, I guess just maybe I'll talk to everyone else. I would highlight one of the examining the question that I think Representative Newman is forwarding on the success of Minneapolis in integrating. There's one set of facts that I wrote down from, I believe it was Ms. Boyer's testimony, that in 1990, Minneapolis's overall population was 22% families of color, and today it's 35% families of color. So we've seen a 50% in round numbers increase in 10 years there. Secondly, and I forget, but I believe in 1973 we had 19% students of color in Minneapolis, and in 2005 we had 73% students of color. So when we look at has Minneapolis been successful or not, I think we can't pretend that the ground has been frozen in place over that time period. And in fact, the ground has changed dramatically. Secondly, I think that the district has raised a good and very accurate point about while we tend to approach this as a black-white issue, even amongst the African, there's sharp differences in culturally and between the African and the African-born and African-American populations. It's a much more nuanced issue than simply black and white. And then I guess last point to Representative Newman. I think there's a reason that the Itasca Project's Mind the Gap report follows this, because I think if we fail to examine integration in Minnesota in light of the stark segregation in Minnesota, we're missing the core of the issue. And in Minnesota, as was testified to many, the Twin Cities is one of the most racially segregated areas in the country.
Which we will get to later. We have the Mind the Gap report at the end of this this hearing, if we ever get to the end of this hearing. And shall we go back to WEMAP?
Madam Chair, members, again, my name is Dr. Daniel Jett, and I'm superintendent of the West Metro Education Program. And officially, we are Joint Powers District 6069, but we're affectionately known as WEMAP, and we keep that name because we like the WE and WEMAP, and it kind of reminds us that we're in it together. Back to your packet. On your left side in the rear, there are two diagrams. And if some of you are visual learners like I, maybe this will be helpful for you to get an eyeball view of who and what WEMAP is. Should be on your left in the back. I'm not sure which order they're in, but the one identifies West Metro Education Program and our member districts. We are a voluntary consortium of districts that have come together to partner with Minneapolis, which was our racially isolated neighbor. You'll notice that all of the districts, starting up with St. Anthony, New Brighton, and working your way around counterclockwise.
You can put it on the way.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. That'll be next. That one first. Starting again with St. Anthony, New Brighton, working around to your left, you'll notice all of those districts that are non-yellow or non-light yellow are contiguous in border with Minneapolis. Thus, the rule applies. The two districts in that map that do not contact Minneapolis border are Wayzata and Eden Prairie. Those districts have been referred to previously as voluntary districts. So that is the sum and total of WEMAP. It's an 11-member consortium between or among Minneapolis and those 10 suburban districts. And if you'll keep that membership in mind as I make my remarks, it might be helpful. I do want to briefly, though, show you another map just for a zoom up to another level. This is a map that shows the three integration districts that service the metropolitan Minneapolis-St. Paul area. There's WEMAP, the other one is EMID, you'll hear from EMID later, and then earlier referred to was the Northwest Suburban Integration District. And this is how those three districts lie in your metropolitan area. Finally, back to the packet, if I could. You have information in this packet that describes in one way or another the four major activities that the West Metro Education Program conducts on behalf of its member districts and their staff. And let me remind you that these member districts have approximately 110,000, 115,000 students who attend schools in the aggregate in those districts, and there are literally thousands of staff members who are employed in those districts. We do four things. One, we operate two magnet schools, and there's brochures in the magnet schools. These schools are the inter-district downtown school that was at 10th and Hennepin, still is, that was alluded to earlier. It is a K-12 school. It enrolls 600 students, and the 600 students arrive daily from all of those 11 districts, and they return home via buses back to those 11 member districts. It opened in 1999, was built with state funds, as you may recall. And our second school is located in Crystal. There's a brochure in there about the FAIR School. And FAIR is our acronym for Fine Arts Interdisciplinary School, which is a grades 4 through 8 arts magnet. Same deal, 560 students from the 11 member districts arrive each day. Each district is allotted a certain number of seats based on their proportion of enrollment in the total district. And if they have more parents and families interested in attending than they have seats, then they create a lottery for enrollment. The second thing WEMAP does is we conduct a very significant adult learning program, sometimes called staff development. A among all of those schools that I alluded to, we bring teachers, principals, superintendents, board members, and others together for a very significant staff development program around diversity. And if you look on the right side of your packet, you have one artifact of that work, and it's called the Cultural Collaborative. And as you have time, you might peruse the different, quote, courses that are offered. RUMAP provides the courses. Our member district staff sign up. We engage the presenters and instructors who, as you know, the literature, some of these are very high-profile, significant contributors in the world of multiculturalism and so forth, and they do a great job for us. The other area of adult learning that is not in your packet is a major initiative we have with the National Urban Alliance. And I'm not going to take time to go too far into it, but I'll be happy to respond to questions around all of our adult learning programs if you have interest, or I'll be happy to get more information for you. The third activity RUMAP conducts has to do with student learning programs. In this program, we have students from suburbs as well as the inner city come together on weekends for leadership training during summer programs and so forth. And the fourth area, and I apologize, I'm going a little quick, I kind of got a sense that we're time sensitive. The fourth area is the choice is yours. I hope I can clarify, at least from our perspective, the choice is yours was the result, initially, of a settlement agreement that was alluded to earlier. RUMAP was not party to the litigation. However, RUMAP was available and volunteered to be the administrative arm of operating the choice is yours, which we did for the 4 years in which the settlement was in place. The settlement ended last June 30th, and RUMAP decided, its board, decided to keep the choice is yours as part of our program for the ensuing four-year period for which we've already filed our integration plan. So I know it's 1 year at a time, but our intent is to stay with it through the next four-year cycle. We do, in fact, have about 1,600 students enrolled. One difference about this program is that students who participate in the Choice is Yours must be Minneapolis residents, and their families must qualify for free and reduced lunch. So the added component is children of poverty as measured by free and reduced lunch qualifications. In your packet, I also have material about the evaluation of our programs. This is an executive summary, or executive brief. It's on the right side. We contract with Aspen Associates, and we have them evaluate our programs. We try to focus our programs so that they do the following. One, so that we help mitigate the racial isolation that Minneapolis has. Two, student achievement of all students who are come under our purview. Three is to generally support integration in the community. And fourth, we try to do that by offering programs, as you can see, by having staff, students, and parents learn both from and with each other. And when they come from diverse backgrounds, we think that hits the mark on what we should be about. Finally, the last document in your folder that I want to mention is I prepare for our Joint Powers Board. And by the way, each of our 11 districts has two members who sit on our board, the governing board. And 11 of them are superintendents, and 11 of them are sitting board members. They are our governance board. They asked me once the legislative auditor's report came out to take a look at it and to give my reflections on what some of the implications might be. And the first thing I told them was I thought the legislative auditor's report was very professional, very thorough, very helpful. We were one of the districts interviewed for it. We found the professionalism to be at the highest level. When you look at the recommendations in the report, we find them to make sense to us. We think that best practice conferences and meetings convened by the department certainly make sense. What we're doing in WEMAP or what's being done in EMID or what's being done in the southwestern part of the state should in fact be shared, and regret we didn't think of that and do it sooner, but we certainly agree with that. The oversight by the department has already begun. We certainly are okay with that. The department last spring issued guidelines for the first time for the use of integration revenue. Our member districts complied. Our member districts had some of their plans sent back for clarification, and once clarified, they then received approval. The eight recommendations, if I'm remembering correctly, have the most implication, I think, in number one and number eight. Number one is clarifying the purpose of the integration program. That certainly makes sense. We'd like to be party to that discussion, not today, but at some point in time. We don't necessarily have the right answer, but we have some experience. And the fact that we have Minneapolis and 10 suburban districts voluntarily working together seriously and intentionally around integration of this region of our world seems to us to be a pretty significant undertaking for us. The eighth one has to do with examining the funding. It's not a formula, but the funding distribution. There are a lot of ways to come at that. Each one will perhaps, each change might create winners and losers, if you will, to the current plan. But again, if it's aligned, as the auditor's report seems to want us to be, is aligned, in other words, purpose, activities, expenditures, and then accountability, it certainly makes sense to us. One final comment, and then I'll be happy to stand for any questions you might have. We'd like to make sure that the concept of voluntary districts is clearly understood, at least from our perspective. The department does have approval over voluntary districts, integration plans, and whether or not they receive revenue in accordance with the plan. What has been missing is their membership in a consortium. For example, when Eden Prairie and Wayzata joined LUMEP, it was a LUMEP Joint Powers Board decision that they would be admitted to membership after determining whether or not they could constructively contribute to our mission, which I've outlined previously. In other words, can a district reasonably participate in our magnet schools? Can a district reasonably receive children from the choices yours? Are their staff prepared to engage in the activities that our adult learning program? So it's those kinds of questions. To have the department take a look at that for voluntary membership is fine with us. We think we've done due diligence on that, and we'd be happy to do that as well. However, I want to emphasize that whatever success LUMEP has, going from east, meaning Minneapolis, north to our district, south to our district, and moving west, it is that collaboration between and among those that is really the fabric of our success, and included in that are our voluntary districts. It is a powerful statement when you look at that map to name off the communities, the cities, and the city councils, and the mayors, and the people who are potentially impacted by the good work we do. So I would encourage you to consider voluntary districts as our friends and as our partners, because we certainly do. Madam Chair, I'll pause there for questions.
I have a couple of quick questions, Dr. Jett. First of all, I think you mentioned 1,600 students that come from Minneapolis to all of these districts.
That's correct.
I'm kind of curious about the distribution of those students, and then I wondered also, is there a waiting list? Are others who are waiting to get in, and you have a maximum? And how does the choice of yours pay for this?
Madam Chair, members, there's a couple questions in there.
Yes.
To my knowledge, there's not a waiting list. Minneapolis could respond to that perhaps better. When the original plan was set up, when it was under the settlement,
mm-hmm.
My understanding is that the goal was approximately 2,000 students.
Okay.
So we're not at the goal. What we would do when we get to the goal remains to be seen, but we're not at that initial goal of 2,000. Not a requirement, but it was a goal. Secondly, it's paid for. Minneapolis transfers its state aid and other local aids to LUMEP for us to operate those schools. So it's a tuition basis, and the tuition is comprised of most, if not all, of the aids that those students would receive if had they remained a student in Minneapolis. Transportation, however, is provided, I believe, under integration revenue.
Okay.
Again, someone can speak to that if I misspeak. Was there a third question, Madam Chair?
I was curious the distribution of the students among your cooperating districts.
I'll be happy to get that for you and send it to your office. I have a chart, but I don't have it with me.
Representative.
Dr. Jett, thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jett, you indicated that you value the partnership of the voluntary districts. My question is, how viable would the WEMEP program continue to be if the voluntary districts were not a part of the cooperative?
Madam Chair and Representative, that's a little hard to quantify, so I'll give you my best guess. And I don't want to go to the extreme and say WEMEP would just follow its knees and be unsuccessful. I don't believe that for a minute. But it just seems like it's leverage. The, you know, we start with Minneapolis and the contiguous districts, and then we affect a larger and larger region, and we have more hands doing the work, more opportunities for the message of living together in ways that's good for our community, just has more opportunity to spread. I would be deeply disappointed, saddened, and I think it would be opportunity lost if we didn't have those member districts, because I think they're a powerful part of our team.
Representative Meslow, okay. Any other questions for this group? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Dr. Jett, have you ever tracked the students, the 1,500 in 2004 for Minneapolis and now the 1,668 in 2005? Have you ever tracked them to see what becomes of them after they've left? The choice is yours. Have they gone off to college? Have they, benefited in some specific way? Have you done any kind of follow-up study like that?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, thank you for asking that question. It was on my list to mention and I didn't. We are currently awaiting the release of a significant study of the impact of the Choice is Yours program. It is not specific to the postgraduate, post-high school period to which you allude. However, the goals of the program were to answer some questions about students being more successful if they're in a different environment. The report has been completed by Aspen Associates. In the document I referred to that has evaluation information in it, you'll find it's missing there. We partner with the Department of Education for that evaluation, and it's to be released tomorrow, next day, next week. It is imminent. It's embargoed. I can't tell you what's in it except, I can't tell you what's in it except that it's a pretty favorable report. Both, in a couple areas. One, student achievement. Two, parent and student participation in the suburban districts. Positive. And some interesting data has surfaced that is really reinforcing for our adult learning program, and that is that participants in the Choice is Yours program report that their suburban teachers are well-equipped to handle children of poverty and diversity. And that links right back to the adult learning program that I alluded to earlier vis-a-vis the cultural collaborative coursework and the National Urban Alliance work we do. So I can't wait for that report to come out, and I hope you'll get it just really soon.
And one last question. Representative Eric.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Dr. Jett, are all the money transfers tracked then through the UFARS?
Madam Chairman and Representative Eric, I'm sure that's the case. But I'm not sure if you had a specific question. We follow, as a school district, we fall under the same reporting requirements as all public schools, and we use all of the categories and reporting as everyone else would. So the answer is yes, I think we would.
Thanks. Dr. Jett, were you still planning? There was a time that WEMAP was pursuing a third school. Are you still working on that, or is that kind of off the table?
It's not off the table, but it's towards the edge of the table. Madam Chair, we are doing an evaluation of our two schools now, and we think there's some additional opportunity to reconfigure a bit the two schools that were originally kind of started, with a lot of faith. You know, this K-12 school downtown is going to work, isn't it? And it has. But we're looking at the high school component there because it's fairly small in enrollment just because of the size of the school. We now have an opportunity, we think, to link it to our suburban school. We're trying to think strategically. For example, and this is a little off, but I think you'll get the connection. We previously offered summer school in sessions that met 2 weeks at a time at FAIR and at IDDS at the same time. And then we had an aha. What if we offer 2 weeks at FAIR and then downtown so that children get both a suburban and an urban experience? And it just made a lot of sense for us. So we're trying to think through what connections might we make with the FAIR school to IDDS. FAIR ends at 8th grade. We've got a small high school population downtown. You know the location of 10th and Hennepin. FAIR is an art school. Things start to come together here. So the third school could well come back into our strategic plan if, in fact, we did some configuration changes, and we're not ready to announce that, but if we did, we may indeed want to think about a K-3 school that would open up more room downtown for secondary program, and we're really interested, or at least I'm very interested, our board hasn't voted yet, so I have to qualify it, in some sort of academy. We'd like to think about, could we create a school with children from all 10 districts that when children left third grade, there was no achievement gap? What would it take to do that? And then if those...
We'd love to see you do that.
And then if those children fit our two magnet schools... so anyhow, that's a long answer, I apologize, but it's on the edge of the table, but it's not off.
We have one last question, I think, for you probably, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Jett, in the auditor's report, they discussed the lack of clarity on the use of integration aid revenue and listed a number of categories that they placed a number of the answers in, and one was staff development. And I'm concerned that there was an implication that staff development was not an appropriate use of integration aid. I'm wondering if, I'm looking at this cultural collaborative booklet of yours, I'm wondering if you could just speak briefly to the role of staff development in integration efforts.
Madam Chair and Representative Dabnik, it's really crucial to the work we do. When we look at the data that I just alluded to from The Choice Is Yours, and we have families and students reporting that their teachers clearly have learned how to better interact academically with children of poverty and from diverse backgrounds, that pushes out to the academic achievement that we're talking about. We have, and I don't have the data in front of me, but we have literally thousands of teachers who participate with us. We have speakers like Ruby Queen, who's a national speaker on children and families of poverty, doing two-day workshops with teachers. You have children of poverty in your class. What does it mean to the professional, et cetera? Just one example. Our National Urban Alliance work has a great deal of that. So I couldn't probably overstate the importance of that to our work. It's crucial, and the integration revenue that we receive, we being WEMAP, does not come to us from the state. We're not on that list. It's because our member districts agree to jointly send funds, and they ask us to create these opportunities, which leverages their dollars. If you look at the size disparity of those districts around the edge, some are small, some are bigger, the opportunity, particularly for smaller districts, to have enough money to engage in the high-level staff development, the people we're bringing, and so forth, it would be virtually impossible for them. So they agree to send funds to WEMAP, and they say to their governing board, and here's what we want you to create, and then we create it. So it's really important to us. To give you a magnitude of it, districts send to WEMAP about $3 million of their integration aid a year. Keep in mind that integration aid is also part local. There's a local component to that. So, thank you.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to move on to St. Paul. I'm sure there might be people who want to snag you and ask additional questions, but we really do have to move here. So, Mary Gilbert, I believe you are going to introduce your St. Paul folk.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert. I'm the legislative liaison for the St. Paul Public Schools. I'm also a parent of children in the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I don't know where Jackie is, but my son will never be happy again if he doesn't get into South. The St. Paul Public Schools is fully committed not just to the intent of the rule, but goes way beyond it to provide all the students in St. Paul with a world-class educational opportunity, and in an inclusive learning environment that reflects the cultures, language, and intellectual contributions of all of our students and families in St. Paul. We've been a national leader in providing voluntary student choice. We were cited in the early 80s for having racially isolated schools, and with the help of the federal government, we got the beginnings of a wide system of magnet schools up and running, and Dr. McGee is here to talk about one of our successful programs at Central High School, and we also have a couple of parents who graciously agreed to share their experience as users of the system today. We, as I mentioned, we do have a voluntary school choice program, which is a combination of magnet schools, small learning communities, and a good network of neighborhood schools as well. One of the notions of a voluntary system is you have to give people the choice of staying in their own neighborhood if you prefer that as well. And 96% of our secondary students got their first or second choice, and 83% got their first or second elementary choice. We spent about close to $11 million on transporting those kids to those choices that are beyond their neighborhood schools. That's out of $14.7 million of state aid. We have a local levy of $6.3 million, but the district is so committed to our integration program that we put another $6.9 million from our general fund to support our integration activity in St. Paul. So we far exceed what the state provides in both state aid and local levy. We spend the bulk of the money, as I said, on transportation. The key to that as well is that we have a highly mobile population in St. Paul, and because we do provide this transportation for choice, a family that moves several times in the St. Paul school actually can stay and remain in the same school, and that's one of the greatest side benefits we have to providing that choice for our families. As all of you know, the fewer transitions kids and families make from school to school, the better academic progress they tend to make. The remaining part of our integration aid is spent for magnet specialists to support our magnet programs, to provide the multicultural curriculum and training and opportunities. We do over 110 parent outreaches last year in addition to our parent fair. And we have a former staff person, Dave Norgaard, who used to staff the committee, who developed a choice website that both Minneapolis and St. Paul are using that is available in not only English, but Hmong, Somali, and Spanish. And they would love to show off the website by Urban Planet at some point, but I told them we didn't have enough time today. We do celebrate the astounding diversity we have in St. Paul, and we agree with the Minneapolis recommendations that diversity under the rule could be more expansive. We have 26% white students that are white, 29.3% African-American, nearly 30% Asian-American, 12.5% Hispanic, and almost 2% Native American. So as you can see, we do celebrate the diversity in our schools, and our school populations reflect that. We have over 1,500 staff members or administrators who use the district's Multicultural Resource Center that we share with our EMED partner, as well as 500 inter-district partnerships with EMED, which Carl Wallstrom is going to share with you today as well. I just want to thank all of you folks who have in some way been involved in having this be a successful program. Our first voluntary inter-district partnership was formed when Mindy Greiling, Representative Greiling, was still on the Roseville School Board. The previous chair of the Education Committee was imminently involved with that, and Karen Cleansing kind of carried the ball. So over since 1980, we've all worked to make this kind of astounding voluntary effort move forward. And then I guess the telling tale, too, is in addition to us having this integration opportunities for students, we've also addressed the student outcome. Our district has sustained progress, and I think you've gotten handouts both of the choice brochure and our student achievement data that came out. We're closing the achievement gap in all groups, but particularly in Asian American, English language learners, and poor and low income. When you look at our third and fifth grade test scores, we've doubled the number of kids in math and reading in third and fifth grade, according to the state test, where two-thirds of our students in those classes are proficient. We've also, and you'll hear about this in Minding the Gap report, we've also nearly doubled the amount of kids that are taking the ACT test and the minority students taking the ACT test. And so in every indicator, we're moving in the right direction. But let me... Now it's time to, no more statistics, let's hear from the users of the system.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting us, Madam Chair.
Thank you for
members
being
of the
here.
Committee. I'm Mary McPhee. I'm principal of St. Paul Central High School. I'm completing my 13th year there as principal, arrived in 1993. Prior to that, I arrived in St. Paul in 1966 as a teacher of color recruit from New Orleans. And during that time, as you know, was the heyday of school desegregation in the South. And so a lot of white flight. A lot of teachers lost their jobs. And as a newly graduate of a college, I was recruited as a teacher of color to come to St. Paul. And I'm happy to say I'm still here. And I'm unhappy to say there's no New Orleans left. But anyway, and just to let you know, I'm a product myself of de jure segregated schools from New Orleans. I attended segregated elementary, secondary schools, and also had the fortunate opportunity to attend a historic black college. But right now, I'm Central High School's principal and have been there for 13 years, and I've seen a lot of changes. When I first arrived at Central in 1993, it was not necessarily a school of choice. It was not a popular school. Our location, the history of issues at that school did not make it very attractive to a lot of white students. At the time, prior to my coming, it was considered probably the most racially identified high school in terms of its minority population. And in the late 1980s, with the aid of integration revenue, the school began a gifted and talented program to attract more white students to the school, to integrate the school. And we have been successful. I've given you a brochure that gives you our statistics as of today. Right now we are 37% white, which is a little higher than the district average for secondary students at 21%, and 33% minority, which is a little lower than the district average of the traditional high schools. And we attribute that ability to attract students of all colors and all economic standing with the predominance of our highly acclaimed, gifted, and talented programs. And we attract students of all color into those programs. In addition to that, you can see some of the testing, too, that we look very well in terms of our overall testing in the ACT, the SAT, state data. We have four programs that we use to attract students, International Baccalaureate, Advanced Placement, College in the Schools, and also our homegrown test program, which started actually in the 1970s, and with our original program to attract majority students to the central campus. We have a lot of programs in our building that we use integration funding for to support particularly our students of color who are in these programs. We fund our Central Minority Education Program, which is an academic support program that offers tutoring and one-on-one counseling for students of color who might need additional support to be successful in the Gifted and Talented Program. And that program is located in the same site as the Gifted and Talented Coordinator, so they work as a complete unit to indicate to the students and to the staff that that's a joint effort in terms of trying to get our students to be successful. Our money is primarily used for specialized staff in those areas, as well as for the additional support programs that we offer, both during school hours and also after school hours. And because we are a school of choice, and I think at one point we had children from about 49 different elementary and middle schools attending our school. They come from traditional public school, middle schools, private school, K-8, some charters. And part of the program that we've had over the years is a wonderful freshman retreat where we try to bring all the kids together for a full day of co-mingling and trying to get to know one another and appreciate different cultures and different economic backgrounds. In addition, we have a plethora of courses that we offer that we think is attractive to students from all walks of life. We are probably the only high school that still offers, well, we know we're the only high school in St. Paul that still offers German as a language. We also offer five other languages. As we see the need of our students, we offer Russian, Chinese, German, French, Spanish, and Latin. I think we're the only public high school around that still offers Latin. But we try to have a variety of courses and programs to maintain that diversity in our building. And when we talk to our parents and our students, especially our white parents, who still choose to attend a public school in St. Paul, their main purpose is the diversity as well as the variety of courses and programs that we're able to still offer with a great deal of success. So I'd be open to any questions, but I implore you to look at the brochures that I've given to you. And also, we are in sight of your Capitol building. When I'm on the fifth floor of one of our classrooms, I can see your Capitol building. So we are a school that's in your neighborhood, so I encourage you to come and visit as often as you would like.
Thank you very much. Mr. Huckleby here?
Yes. My name is Sean Huckleby. I'm a parent of four children. I was asked because I spanned decades with the St. Paul Public Schools. But I think my concerns as a parent of color really align with every parent in the district, and that is really trying to match the educational needs of my children with the educational offerings of each of the individual schools in the district. And also my concerns as a parent in terms of making sure that my kids are enrolled in programs that offer academic rigor, but have a environment of safety that encourages parental involvement and participation. And I think that the district in St. Paul really supports my concerns by providing me the kinds of information that I need to make informed choices. We have the school fair once a year where all the schools participate in terms of talking with parents as they're choosing school options in terms of what the programs are, the various offerings that they have, and where they are located. So it helps me make my choice. Each of the individual schools have school showcases and open houses, which also was a way for me to inform, for my wife and I to make informed choices about the educational needs of our children. I think that this information and this ability to make informed choices has really contributed to the success of my children. My oldest daughter is a graduate of Central High School. She went through the IB program at Central. She's a University of Minnesota graduate. She's getting her master's in May from Metropolitan State University in Public Policy, currently works for the St. Paul Public Housing Agency. My second daughter graduated from the University of Minnesota. She's enrolled at Hamline University, getting her master's in education, and was hired by the university as the assistant registrar for the U of M Law School. My son is a junior at the U, and my youngest daughter, our late-in-life surprise, is a eighth grader at Murray Junior High School, and she's in the math and science program there. But I would just like to say that by becoming engaged in schools, by having a choice as to where you send your child, it also helps you make a choice. It helps you make a commitment to that school, and I think that we've seen an increase in parental involvement. We've seen an increase in parent participation. We've seen an increase in volunteerism. And I think the school district as a whole, as a matter of public policy, has encouraged that through the emphasis on site-based school management in the St. Paul School District. Finally, I would just like to relate a meeting I was at last week with the Asian American community here in the Twin Cities, and the place I work at during the day was approached to have a meeting with them. And also attending the meeting was the newly appointed director of the White House Initiative on Asian American Affairs. And at that committee meeting that we had here in the Twin Cities, we had representatives from the Hmong community, the Laotian community, the Cambodian community, the Chinese community, the Korean community, the Japanese community, and from various parts of the communities from India. And it struck me as we sat down and began to talk about the issues that related to their various communities, the needs are different, the issues are different as it relates to each of these communities. So as you look at this issue in terms of immigration dollars and how they're used by the districts, certainly oversight is appropriate. Trying to define mission is appropriate, but districts need flexibility so that they can meet the changing needs of their school population, so that they can meet the needs of their students.
Thank you very much, Mr. Huckleby. Dr. Wallstrom.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Carl Wallstrom. I'm the superintendent of the East Metro Integration District. My colleague Dan Jett, who is before you within the past few minutes, did a nice job of explaining a joint powers district on the west side of town. We are the equivalent in partnering with St. Paul in nine suburban districts on the east side of the metropolitan area. The map that was shown before is in your packets. On the right side, you have a blue packet that looks like this. Should have in your materials. And these items include a map that would identify the 10 districts who comprise Enid. The legislative auditor's report also had those districts identified in the PowerPoint presentation. So I would ask you to reconnect a little bit with those districts. They're shaded green on the map, and they include the racially isolated district, St. Paul Public Schools, and nine of its member districts. I'd like to just comment generally that Enid's focus is in three major areas. We too operate two magnet schools, just like our friends on WEMEP. Our two magnet schools, our Harambe Elementary School is located in Maplewood, and the Crosswinds School located in Woodbury. And I too want to thank members of this committee and members of the legislature for past support of our bonding efforts to construct those schools and to make them available to our constituents. Those schools are very successful. They are well integrated. About 50% of the students come from St. Paul. The remaining students come from the member districts. What's perhaps a little bit different about those two schools is that they operate on year-round calendars on a 45-15 kind of schedule, and I'd be happy to answer questions about that if you have them. Beyond that, they are fairly successful, as I would say, in terms of meeting the goal of balancing student populations across the collaborative. They are both AYP schools. We have achievement gap issues we're working on, but we're making progress. Our second major area of focus would be what I would call intentional efforts to increase interracial student contact between students in St. Paul and the suburban communities. We bring students together sometimes on weekends, sometimes during the year, sometimes during the summers, to increase opportunities for them to grow and learn together. Project Common Ground and the Five District Partnership are two programs with brochures in your folders that are examples of those efforts. We are also initiating new programming design around those efforts in the very near future. A third area of our emphases would be in what we would call integration services. Mary mentioned the Multicultural Resource Center that we support at the Arlington High School through our collaborative efforts. And a secondary would be an office that creates classroom partnerships between St. Paul and the member districts. This year we have over 500 of those partnerships that again bring students together around common areas of learning related to integration and multicultural education. Those are the three major emphases of our collaborative. The funds are distributed similar to what Dr. Jett mentioned for West Metro. The EMID districts raise the funds and distribute them then to EMID to conduct these programs. About 30% of our budget comes from integration revenue. The remaining portion of our funds comes from tuition for students who reside in the member districts, and we receive a small percent, about 2% of federal funds to support our title programs. With regard to the legislative auditor's report, we have provided for you an EMID response to each of those eight recommendations. We hope that you will study that at your leisure. And today, if you have questions about our position, we'd be happy to respond. We think in general, just as Dr. Jett mentioned, that this is a favorable review of integration revenue. We see different recommendations affecting our districts differently depending upon their set of circumstances. But in general, we would support most of the recommendations in a general sense, and we welcome the opportunity to work with the legislature in crafting responses to each of these recommendations. Our collaborative has taken a position, on these recommendations. They would ask that I share with you at least three major points to leave with you this morning. The first major point we'd like to make is that we believe integration benefits all students. We believe that the beneficiaries of meaningful integration are students of all races, including white students, students who have become the numerical minority in some schools within our area. We believe that effective integration initiatives need to include culturally responsive practices that lead to improved academic achievement for our students. So both of these outcomes, cultural understanding and student achievement, are what we believe this PSEG rule is all about, and they cannot and should not be addressed in isolation. A second point that we would make would be that we wish to be accountable, and I know other collaborative districts do as well. We wish to be accountable for use of these funds. but local flexibility and accountability are not mutually exclusive. We believe that common definitions and a consistent interpretation of criteria for use of these funds would help us improve our uses of integration revenue. At the same time, we need local flexibility to identify needs, articulate strategies, and finally to measure outcomes for our programs. And a third point and final point I would make is that we welcome a meaningful dialogue and a constructive approach to improving uses of integration revenue. We believe that significant input and involvement from all the stakeholders is imperative if we are to have an even more effective use of integration revenue and supporting programs. At this time, I'd like to invite two parents from Enid Schools to share with you their experiences and to reflect for you how this integration revenue has supported the involvement of their children in diverse learning environments. The first individual is going to address you is Amy Gostrin-Ledoux. She has children in both the Harambe and the Crosswinds schools. Amy.
Thank you. As Dr. Wallstrom mentioned, I am a parent of children at both schools in our district. I have one child at Crosswinds and four children at Harambe Elementary. And I'm going to talk to you today about, first of all, my process in choosing the schools that my children attend, and secondly, about our experiences there. When I began looking for schools for my children, we were in District 625, which is the St. Paul School District. And as was already mentioned, there are many, many choices in that school district. I looked at private schools, public schools, charters, magnets. I really took it on almost like a full-time job and just devoted a lot of attention into finding the right school for our family. My family is a multiracial family, so that was important. But regardless of if they were all white children, I still think my choice of putting them at Harambe and then ultimately at Crosswinds was the best decision. There were several components that were very critical for me in finding a school. One of them was, because it is a voluntary integration school, I figured that other families who chose that school would be like-minded, that they would value diversity and celebrate diversity, and that has been my experience at Harambe. It's part of the mission statement. When I walked into the school on the first day for my walkthrough, it just fit like a glove. For me, it was like the process of buying a home. You look for several important components, and then once you walk through the door, you know it's the right choice. And that was my experience when I finally found Harambe and made the decision to send my children there. Another important component for me was having a well-thought-out restitution program, because I know my children and they can be rather rambunctious. I did not want to set them up for failure. And at Harambe, they have a wonderful restitution program, and my children have spent very little time in the planning center, but because it is well thought out, I knew that they wouldn't be isolated. I knew that they wouldn't be identified in a negative way, but they would be a part of the process. It would be a constructive process so that they could be successful. Another thing that has been very beneficial for us, well, one thing that Mary mentioned was because families can move but continue to attend the same school, I can really address that. If we had not chosen Harambe, but instead had been a part of, say, a neighborhood school, my children would have gone to five different schools in three different districts. We began in St. Paul. We now live in Washington County. So they have had the benefit of that consistency of being at the same school all throughout their academic year. And they would have fallen through the cracks if they had had to make that many changes in their early years. Another is because of the multi-age classroom environment. I have two girls who excel in every area, and because it's a multi-age environment, they're able to do that. They're able to be leaders in their classroom. But additionally, I have three boys who struggle with learning disabilities and have support services provided for them. But because it's a multi-age classroom, they are not set apart. They're able to be a part of the academic curriculum, be a part of the classroom, and it's not as obvious to them as well as their classmates that they are students who struggle. They're able to go at their own pace, whether they excel or whether they need additional services. And I think that's about all that I have prepared, so I'm going to pass the mic.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Whitlock? And please be as brief as you can. We are running really short on time here.
Sure.
Thank you.
My name is Patrice Whitlock. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I will make it very brief. I do concur with many of the things that Amy just spoke about. I am a mother of three children. I actually have a son that has graduated from Crosswinds Middle School, and I have a fifth grade daughter who we are in, have applied to Crosswinds so that she can hopefully spend her middle school years there. And I guess what I'll do is just briefly describe why we chose Crosswinds as the school for my son to attend and why we're looking to hopefully get my daughter in there. The basic reason is because of really the cultural diversity that exists at the school. I felt like, my husband and I felt like there was more of that at that particular school than the middle school in our district. We are from 622, which is the North St. Paul Maplewood Oakdale Middle School school district. And Crosswinds seemed to, in our opinion, address some of the cultural issues that we think is important to our family. Neither my husband or I are from Minnesota. I'm from Illinois. He's from Michigan. Both of us come from areas where we experience predominantly attending African-American schools, and we came here for undergrad. That's where the two of us met. We actually graduated from the University of Minnesota Morris, which is obviously a very small community. For both of us, attending the University of Minnesota, it was a cultural shock for the both of us, but it also gave us an opportunity to learn a lot about other cultures. And it was just a great experience for us. But now raising our children in Minnesota, there's a piece and a component for them that we have to be very purposeful about in their lives. And the cultural piece in their lives tends to be missing in their education. And so in looking at schools for our children, we want to make sure that there's a broad cross-section of students from various different cultures, so that they can have that experience of meeting and, you know, interacting with people of different backgrounds, and we felt that Crosswinds provided that for our family. So I'll just leave that.
Thank you very much. Are there any quick questions for any of our testifiers in the St. Paul area and Magnet School area? Hearing none, I will thank you very much for being here.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the time and the thoughtful consideration of this important issue. Thank you.
Thank you. And this is purely information for all of us. We have no legislation before us today. Mr. Williams joined us from the Rochester schools and would like to address the committee briefly also.
Madam Chair. Representative Greiling. Just a question before we hear Dr. Williams. Do you have, I know it's open-ended like it was yesterday, but many members in planning their calendars for today, because we didn't know they were open-ended, have a, you know, thought we would be ending at noon or even 1:45 as if this were a committee. So are you, how long, just because I know some have had to leave.
It depends on whether or not you want to hear the Mind the Gap. I don't think Mr. Williams will take very long. But
so that's the last.
I added
the Mind the Gap.
Mind the Gap is our last thing on the
And deal. Madam Chair, are you taking testimony from anybody?
If somebody wants to testify, they may, but we have somebody presenting the report.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jerry Williams, superintendent in Rochester. I appreciate the opportunity to make a few brief comments because there is an outstate Minnesota interest in this topic. I first of all want to say that we, as a Rochester Public Schools, were also interviewed for the Legislative Auditor's Report. Appreciated that opportunity. I agree with the Legislative Auditor in that the Integration Aid has accomplished good things in the state of Minnesota. I also agree with a couple, and I'm paraphrasing questions. Is the funding being distributed fairly? And are all districts that receive this additional funding held to standards that are tied to identified needs? Our plan, our budget, and our expenditures have regularly been approved by the Minnesota Department of Education. I specifically want to mention Cindy Jackson, an MDE person who has worked very closely within our school district and has been a strong asset to our integration committee. We are now operating under a 2005-2008 integration plan. A couple things about Rochester. We are at 26% minority and continue to increase and have increased every year since 1985-86. We are estimating that within 5 years we will be at 33%. We have a variety of ethnicities coming to us from all over the world. Currently, we have 66 languages that are spoken in our school district. That is significant for an outstate district. I know that that's just a small number compared with some of the metro area districts, but it is significant for an outstate district, and it brings complexities to our school district that are very unique to outstate Minnesota. Integration applies to our non-English speakers, the whole discussion of integration, the topic of integration, the integration aid applies as well to our non-English speakers as it does to our English-speaking students who are either born and raised in Rochester or who come to our community. Funding is an issue. I will mention that on the top of page 32 of the Legislative Auditor's Report, it specifically mentions Rochester in a discussion of funding. This is our plan. And this is the kind of plan that we put together prior to the 2005-2008 plan. We had a 2002-2005 plan. This plan very specifically lays out and mentions our integration task force members. It has detailed information regarding our strategic plan, what kind of results we're looking for, what are the processes, what's the leadership involved, and it starts at the school board level. My office is actively involved. My cabinet is involved in building leadership involved. It has a student and stakeholder focus embedded in it. It has pages and pages of action plans with timelines, specific results to justify the use of the expenditure of dollars that we're going to be receiving in our school district. It has detailed analysis of results. This analysis of results is looked at from a longitudinal standpoint. We go back to the 2001-2002 school year, and we're tracking these results every year to find out if these do, in fact, make a difference. We have a detailed budget attached to this, and what kinds of things does the integration budget support in our school district? First of all, let me mention that of the total budget, $1.6 million for this school district, $1.6 million for this year comes from state aid. The balance, $720,000, comes from a local levy. That's what the community of Rochester is putting into this. What do we support? We support some newcomer centers. I mean, we have 16 and 17-year-old students who move into our community who have never been to school before. They've grown up in a refugee camp outside of Nairobi, Kenya, Africa, and we need to bring them into an age-appropriate setting. So we bring them into a high school setting, even though they have a pre-kindergarten level of literacy. We support some additional minority program coordinators, middle school and high school parent student school liaisons. We support some transportation. I noticed earlier that a couple of people commented about transportation. This is critically important to us because it allows students to move throughout the district. And I will point out one of our schools. We have choice schools in Rochester. I think around this area they're primarily called magnet schools. One of our choice schools was the school the governor visited 2 weeks ago. It's a 45-15 plan. They start school about the last Wednesday in July, and they go through the middle of June. They go 45 days on, they go 15 days off. We bring in students to the school from all over Rochester. A lot of that transportation is paid for by integration aid. That individual elementary school, K-5 school, has a 65% minority, a 70% student number of students on free and reduced lunch, and it has the highest test score gains of any school in the Rochester Public Schools.
We also support other integration activities. Many have been mentioned before by previous speakers. Field trips, ACT participation, some summer school participation, some all-day kindergarten participation, and so forth. I am pleased with the work that we have been able to do with our Minnesota Department of Education. The other activity we've been involved with from an integration effort is that we are required to participate in a collaborative with surrounding school districts that was directed by the Minnesota Department of Education, because Rochester is an isolated school district, and for those bordering districts, the Minnesota Department of Education required that they be part of a collaborative. We put a plan together. This plan is very similar to our own plan, action plans for every single school district participating in that collaborative. Funding is an issue. There's no question about it. We've been working with our legislators on that. I've had extensive discussions with Representative Demmer, Representatives Welding and Liebling. A couple of those have met with our integration committee in Rochester to get ideas to bring to you, to bring to the legislature, on how we can address some of the issues that were raised by the legislative auditor's report. It's a good program. Are we supportive of the legislative auditor's report and some of the efforts that they've put forth and ideas and concepts? Absolutely we are, and we're certainly willing to work with the legislature on that. Thank you for the opportunity, Chair Sikora.
Thank you, Superintendent Williams. Are there any questions for Mr. Williams? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Williams, you sparked two questions in my head. You focused much of your discussion on English language learners. And the first question then is, in 2003, the legislature cut ELL funding, as well as artificially truncating it to 5 years and then making that retroactive to 5 years previous. In your experience in Rochester, has the state met your needs for ELL programs for the 66 languages that are spoken in your district?
Representative Dabney, that has had a negative effect in our school district, particularly the limiting of the time frame. We get a student move in, I mentioned 16 and 17-year-olds, they come in as 14-year-olds, they come in as 12-year-olds, and it's going to take a longer period of time to get them up to a proficiency level to pass the test. Many of these students will finish out, and many of them will acquire some credits, but they'll never get a high school diploma because they don't reach the level of skills necessary from an academic English standpoint to take and pass the test. I focus some comments on our ESOL students because, as I said earlier, I think integration involves all students, and that was pointed out here earlier. The students who come to us from Somalia, from the Sudan, from the Bosnian area, from other parts of the world, from South America, have the same kind of needs to integrate into our community and our culture and our society as a student who moves, as a minority student who moves to Rochester from Chicago or Milwaukee or Columbus, Ohio.
Madam Chair, second question.
Representative Dabney, a follow-up.
Thank you. You actually are moving to the other area that I was interested in off of your first comments. Last year, this committee heard a bill by Representative Greiling that was a very narrowly constructed bill to allow some of those older students without much academic background coming into this country, many of them out of refugee camps, as you've described, to continue on in high school beyond the current 21 in order to achieve the levels that we need them to achieve to integrate into society, and the committee did not act on that bill. Do you see that sort of a narrowly targeted and constructed program for those specific learners as something that would be valuable to the Rochester area schools?
It would be valuable to us. I'm not sure I want to run. I want several 21, 23, 25-year-old students walking around our high schools, but yet we do have an adult education center. And so if that funding could go through that adult education center, that would be a real asset for students and young adults in Rochester community, definitely.
Brief follow-up?
One.
Absolutely. So then were you to be allowed to educate those students beyond the 18 or 19-year-old, you would be setting up a program that made sense on the ground in terms of where those students were physically located for their education and what made sense given age differences and the like with the rest of the student population.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, that's absolutely correct. We've got the mechanism in place to do it, and we could start it next Monday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Williams, and really appreciate having. I know we just didn't have time to include schools from all over the state, so I'm glad you were here. Thank you very much, and we're going to move on to the Mind the Gap report. I think what we'll do is ask Ms. Ford-Reedy to go through this report uninterrupted, and then we can have questions afterwards. That way the people who feel they have to leave may leave, and those who wish to ask questions may stay.
Madam Chair, committee members, good afternoon. I prepared a statement that says good morning, but I'm behind the times a little bit.
Thank you very much for
inviting me today. I'm delighted to be here to talk to you about these issues. My name is Jennifer Reedy. I'm the coordinator of the Itasca Project. The Itasca Project is an informal association of Twin Cities leaders who have come together out of concerned that there are some critical issues facing the region that weren't being adequately addressed. Excuse me. It's a CEO-driven effort. And one of the issues that the group identified when it first came together was concern for stark and growing socioeconomic disparities in the region. And the group didn't have much of an understanding of what that even meant. They were motivated primarily out of factoids, you know, startling factoids like the Twin Cities has one of the highest per capita incomes for whites and one of the lowest for blacks. Very troubling factoids that made them want to learn more. And so we commissioned a report from the Brookings Institution to help us understand the nature of these disparities and the magnitude of them and the implications for the region's future. And I will be sharing those results with you today. The overall story of our presentation today is that in Minnesota, not all children are truly above average, that we have large populations of folks who are struggling. And in particular, in spite of our economic strength, we have three types of disparities, disparities based on race, class, and place, which all threaten to undermine our economic competitiveness and quality of life here in the region. And we believe that closing these gaps now is not just the right thing to do, but it's the smart thing to do. It's important to acknowledge the strength of the region, the economic strength, the quality of life strength, extremely well-educated population, I mean, the envy of regions around the world. And it's important to begin with that point because we must recognize that we are actually looking at addressing these issues from a position of strength, which is actually unusual. Typically, when regions galvanize around these issues, it's because there are riots. It's because there is some other crisis that brings the concern to the attention of people and leads to action. So as I mentioned, Brookings looked at the disparities by three ways, race, class, and place. These overlap considerably, but they are different, and truly understanding the dynamics of these disparities requires looking at each separately, and I'm going to very quickly give just a highlight of each, and then we can talk a little bit about why maybe it makes sense from an economic perspective to address them. So race disparities. I could sit here all day and give you more troubling factoids about race disparities. Race disparities cut across every socioeconomic indicator you can imagine, across every racial group we have in the region. For example, the average Twin Cities black resident is earning about half of what a white resident makes. The average Latino Twin Cities resident is five times more likely to be a teen mother. The average Native American Twin Cities resident is five and a half more likely to receive inadequate prenatal care. And a number of these disparities are particularly profound for our more recent immigrant groups. For example, Here you see the poverty rate, the relative poverty rate of the white population at 4% to the sub-Saharan African and Hmong populations. You see nearly a third of the Hmong population in the region lives in poverty. And again, the share of the population that does not have a high school degree, 7% for white, 20% sub-Saharan African, and 55% Hmong. The region is still a very white place. As of the last census, we're 85% white. However, that shows a change from 8% to 15% in 10 years, which is actually a startling change for a region and represents a 110% increase in the non-white population in the region. And all indicators show that this is actually increasing at an ever faster rate. So the story on race disparities is very simple. We have disparities that are tied to race, and our non-white population is growing. Unless these disparities are addressed, we will be trending downward on every regional socioeconomic indicator that we can look at. Class disparities, which is differences among income groups. This just gives you a sense of what the income distribution is in the region. The lowest income quartile group has an average income of about $15,000 up to the highest quintile, which earns above $150,000. The highest income groups are growing faster than the lowest income groups. The disparity is increasing. However, all groups did go up in this census term, which not very many regions can say that, so that's something to be proud of in the midst of some discouraging news. I suspect you are quite familiar with this data. This shows the preparedness of children when they show up for kindergarten. And across all domains that the state tested, children in the low-income category are 2 to 3 times less likely to be prepared for school when they show up at the school doorstep. This, as we go out and talk to groups about this, this is one of the slides that people are most distressed about, because we like to think of education as the great equalizer, and the fact that this gap is apparent before they show up for school and then persists over time is very troubling, I think, to a lot of people. And this disadvantage, of course, continues throughout the education system. What you see here is school results in third grade broken down by race and class. The brighter blue are the students who are earning at least 185% of the poverty level, or their household is, and the darker blue are those who have income threshold lower than that. And across every racial category, lower income kids struggle. They perform much less well than the higher income kids. So race and class overlap quite a bit, but they both matter. Last, place disparities. The core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul have 23% of the overall population, but 54% of the non-white population and 54% of the population in poverty. Place disparities are very much a function of race and poverty disparities, race and class disparities. The core cities experience these disparities at a much higher rate. This population struggling with those issues are much more likely to be concentrated in the core cities. In fact, this is one of those areas where we are dramatically bad relative to other communities in the region. But the ratio of core city poverty to suburban poverty in the Twin Cities is the second worst in the nation. And that puts us in the company of, you know, Newark and Detroit and people that we don't, or regions that we don't usually like to think of as peers. A lot of the issue with place disparities is race and class, but there are other ways in which the suburbs are leaving the cities behind. We know that population growth, income growth, and job growth are dramatically higher in the suburbs than they are in the core cities. And all of these dynamics combined lead to very complicated problems like spatial mismatch for jobs. Now, if you look at this graph, this picture that you see on the screen, the bluest areas are the areas with the highest job growth. You can see that those are sort of on the outer ring of the region. If you have supersonic vision, super great vision, I guess it wouldn't be sonic,
I'm not sure what the right adjective is, supervision, you will be able to see that there are some areas that are ringed in yellow. And those are the neighborhoods that have at least 20% African American population. Those areas are not in the blue spots. You have the areas in the region with populations most in need of economic opportunities separated from the areas of job growth. In fact, by some estimates, half of the African American population in the Twin Cities would have to move in order to be evenly distributed with jobs. This is compounded, of course, by the fact that at least 20% of the households in the region don't have access to a car. Itasca, when we commissioned the work from Brookings, asked for them to go beyond the issues of social justice. Don't just tell us why this is the right thing to do. Can you make an argument that this is the smart thing to do? And we believe they have been able to do that. And their argument is this. First, reducing disparities among race and income groups builds a more competitive workforce. We know this baby boomer retirement crisis is looming. There are these statistics about the hundreds of thousands of educated workers that we're going to need to replace. And the fact is that the kids in our current pipeline to replace these baby boom workers have a poverty rate more than twice as high as the boomers themselves. Given all we know about childhood poverty and the way it relates to educational achievement and to every measure of economic success, this bodes very ill for the quality of the region's future workforce. The second reason is that reducing disparities brings more money into the Twin Cities Metro. That's, you know, increased property taxes. There are a number of ways in which this happens. But it's also true that poverty is expensive. And this isn't just the programs that we automatically assume are related to poverty, but, you know, police costs, fire costs, everything with general administration goes up when you have a high concentration of poverty. And the third reason is that reducing disparities among places will make the region stronger and more competitive. And this is harder for some people to understand and really internalize. But the fact is, study after study shows that the fates of poor cities and suburbs are inextricably tied, that income goes up together, that decreases in poverty rates in the poor cities are, you know, increase overall regional income. And although it's difficult sometimes to have somebody in a suburb realize that their fate is connected to the struggles of an inner-city school child, the fact is, data shows that it is true. So with that, I will end my presentation and just reiterate what I hope were the main points that came across to you, which is that, you know, we're doing fabulously as a region, but we have some very troubling and growing socioeconomic disparities that we need to be concerned about, and we need to act on now to make sure that they do not become crippling. And we believe that these acting on these disparities is not just right, but it's the smart thing to do.
Are there questions for Ms. Ford? Ford Reedy, pardon me.
I'm flexible.
Ford Reedy, pardon me.
I'm flexible.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Reedy, having presented us with very compelling information here from your research at the Itasca Project, is the project authoring or advising or promoting any legislation that we ought to be looking at in this very short, compacted session?
These disparities obviously transcend lots and lots of areas of potential legislation. The Itasca Project itself has one agenda item at the legislature this year. It's a continuation of last year, and that's transportation. And that is, of course, related to these issues. Itasca, in the meantime, is working on invigorating private responses on a number of the other underlying issues, including early childhood development, increasing financial literacy in the region, and working to develop a true tracking system so that we understand our progress on these issues for the region.
Any further questions? I guess you're all hungry. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate that presentation. It ties in nicely with what the rest of our discussion was based on this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, members, and we'll see you tomorrow. Assuming we don't have a very long session, we're going to plan to start about 1. That might even give you time for lunch.
Meeting adjourned. Thank you.